Living to the Fullest with Multiple Sclerosis, Innovations in Cognitive Rehabilitation Research. Please join us for our 2017 Multiple Sclerosis Cultivation event, moderated by Steve Ottobottom. This event was recorded on Thursday, May 4th, 2017, at the Kessler Foundation Conference Center, East Hanover, New Jersey, and was edited and produced by Joan Banks Smith of Kessler Foundation. Let's listen in.
It is my opportunity to introduce a very distinguished panel. And I assure you that tonight you will be a part of this discussion as well. This is not a lecture. This is, in fact, a conversation. We want you and need you to be a part of this conversation. So in that spirit, even though my list here is in order, they are not in order. So I'm going to start with, I changed the numbers here. Put your hands together for Dr. Nancy Cervellotti. And Nancy, let's do this. Even though there's a very detailed description of your title, could you briefly describe your role here at the foundation?
Sure. I am the director of traumatic brain injury and neuroscience research at the foundation. I came to the foundation in 1999 as a postdoctoral fellow right out of graduate school to work with John DeLuca. My training here was initially in multiple sclerosis, as was all of my research. And my focus is cognitive rehabilitation and cognition in neurological illnesses. So I transitioned to traumatic brain injury as my research progressed and we saw that we were really starting to help people. We wanted to help more people. So we started to move some of it into traumatic brain injury, and I do that work in both multiple sclerosis and traumatic brain injury now.
All of that is on one business card. It's incredible. It's amazing. Please welcome Dr. Helen Genova. Doctor, please share.
Thank you. I am a senior research scientist at the Kessler Foundation. I work in the neuroscience and neuropsychology lab. I study people with multiple sclerosis, various cognitive issues. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist by training, so I use neuroimaging techniques such as functional magnetic resonance imaging, diffusion tensor imaging, different techniques to study what's going on in the brain and how it affects people with MS.
Thank you so much. And the young lady I met tonight for the first time, I read about her. I heard great things about her, but I should let everyone know that I've been able to interview everyone who is here tonight. Was not able. Is there something happening in Virginia we need to know about?
My cat is desperate to be on camera right now.
The egos that cats have is a different topic we will not be researching or studying tonight. But I was not able to speak to Stephanie because we couldn't do the Virginia thing. We interviewed everyone here tonight for part of I will let you know, we're doing a series of interviews that will be incorporated into our PBS series over the next several months. And so Meg Walter, who is a registered nurse by profession, is with us tonight. And put your hands together for Meg. Now, Meg, could you tell folks just a little bit about yourself and why you're here tonight?
Okay, I have MS. I was diagnosed 40 years ago. About 20 years ago, 17 years ago, I was looking for something to do in research with MS to learn a little bit more about it. And I found Kessler, and I became a participant in the research studies over the past 17 years. And I've learned a lot from them, as well as they probably learned nicely, you know, going through my brain. But it's been a journey, and it's helped me tremendously. I've grown, and I've learned how to cope with different symptoms of MS that I deal with every day. So I'm very thankful to Kessler.
And we're thankful for you being with us, and we'll talk more about that in just a little bit. And I ask you to join me in welcoming tonight Dr. Lauren Strober. Please share, Doctor.
I am a senior research scientist as well in the neuropsychology and neuroscience laboratory. My research has primarily always been with MS, even prior to my graduate training. I'm a clinical neuropsychologist in training, or by training. My research initially was very much more on secondary factors associated with MS, things such as depression, fatigue, sleep disturbance, pain. More recently, I've shifted to how those are influencing quality of life, and in particular, employment outcomes and other outcomes related to participation in engaging in the world. And I also look at the role of personality and other person-related factors that may, like coping, that can kind of predict how people adapt to having an illness such as MS.
Thank you. And our final panelist here in New Jersey is Dr. John DeLuca. Let's hear it for John.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So I'm the Senior Vice President for Research and Training here at the Kessler Foundation. And I've been here 29 years and actually was the very first scientist hired here at Kessler. So I can tell you when there was very little going on, and to be able to see it grow to where we are today is really wonderful, and I'm really proud of it. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. By the way, now put your hands together. I'm told, Stephanie, that you'll be able to see me here. Stephanie, can you see me here?
I see you. I can.
Yes, and we can see. Put your hands together for Stephanie Buxhoveden. Buxhoveden?
Buxhoveden, you got it right.
Let's hear from me that I got that correct.
Good job.
Stephanie, by the way, your cat's name is?
Umi. She's trying to get all of the spotlight right now. It's ridiculous.
Well, you'll tell us about your cat later, but right now tell us about you and the fact that you are a research participant as well.
Yes. So I was diagnosed with MS when I was 25 years old, which I'm only 21 now, so it's
crazy how that works.
I was a neurosurgical ICU nurse by trade, and I was a neurosurgical ICU nurse before I was diagnosed, and I was a competitive athlete. I was in the process of getting my master's at UMDNJ, which is now Rutgers, and then I started having these weird neurological symptoms. I was numb from the waist down. I couldn't feel my right arm. I couldn't use my right hand. My vision became blurry. As a neuro nurse, I was a little bit in denial because I saw really the effects of neurological disease every single day at work, and I refused to see myself as anything but young and invincible. So I tried to sweep it under the rug as long as I could until, you know, it got to the point where I couldn't no longer deny that something was terribly wrong. So I was admitted to the hospital, the same hospital that I worked in, and after all the diagnostic testing came back, it showed that I was, in fact, now one of the 2.3 million people worldwide living with MS. And shortly after my diagnosis, I became an MS-certified nurse, and I started working at St. Barnabas, which was the same MS center where I was actually a patient. And that really showed me that as a clinician and as someone living with MS, that I could have a huge impact on the community. And I eventually switched directions in my career, and I now work as a nurse practitioner, specializing in the care of other people with MS. And I'm in the pursuit of my PhD because I'm very invested in research, both as a clinician and as somebody living with MS.
Thank you. By the way, that's here for all of our panelists before we go any further. And Stephanie, let me just say to you, because I cannot see you, I'm going to ask you to be very assertive and interject your comments into the conversation, okay? And since you do know New Jersey, I'm assuming that you're willing to do that at any point. You know, it's a Jersey thing. So let me open it up. Let me open it up to the panel. The most significant MS research going on at Kessler Foundation as it relates to cognition is? Take it on, John.
Well, the most significant part as it relates to cognition is the fact that cognition is a hidden disability. That is a disability you don't typically see. You heard a lot of the physical symptoms from our members here. But cognition is something you don't necessarily see but have a profound impact on their everyday lives, and we'll hear about that today. The most unique part, though, I think about what we do here at Kessler is we don't just study cognition. We study how to improve cognition. That's rehabilitation. A lot of people around the world and around the world have been studying cognition and how it's related to the brain. We're interested in how we can make it better because that's what people really want. The patients want to know what can we do to improve our cognition. I think that's really one of the best things that we do here at the Foundation.
Jump in here on this issue of it's on the research itself, because some of the research is similar but also very different. On the quality of life issues connected to MS, what have we found? What have we found in terms of quality of life?
I think what everyone has to really think about is what what makes up someone's quality of life. We use that term loosely. We talk about quality of life all the time, whether it's someone who has multiple sclerosis, someone who has traumatic brain injury, someone who has a spinal cord injury. What do we mean by quality of life? When we use that term, we're talking about everything important to you that maximizes your experience in your everyday life. So your thinking abilities, your memory abilities, your ability to relate to other people, your ability to maintain your energy level and engage in everyday activities, your going to work, being able to go to work and maintain a job, that's so important to what we do, who we are as individuals. We don't just work because that's how we put food on the table. Yes, it's how we put food on the table. But particularly in our country, but even throughout the world, it's part of who we are. So if you take that away from someone, you're truly impacting what we call their quality of life. So we could talk about any of those factors. If we can successfully intervene on any of them, and we're working on intervening on all of them, that has a tremendous impact on someone's ability to really enjoy their life.
Dr. Strobel, let me ask you this. Talk about quality of life. You know, I've got to meet Meg tonight. We talked about having this incredibly positive attitude. She talked about her faith being a piece of that equation and having a wonderful family. And Stephanie, you seem to have a great positive attitude as well. But you've looked at issues of depression. What is the connection, the correlation in the research between MS and depression? And can a positive attitude overcome that? Talk about it.
Right. So we know that depression is extremely common in MS. At least in any sample at any given time, 50% of individuals with MS will report either being depressed or having suffered from depression. But related to also the employment, we were talking about that being a thing of quality of life, one of the greatest proxy we have. We can compare individuals that are thinking about leaving the workforce or staying employed on these factors such as optimism, resilience, adaptive coping skills, a sense of ability of self-efficacy that you can overcome this. That's what really holds people together. I always like to say you kind of who you are is who you are before you had MS, and you're probably going to remain that person. So a way that you focus on the positive, the adaptiveness, the resilience, the social support, your strengths can get you through this. And that seems to be what we're finding in our research.
By the way, the research you did with 107 patients, was it, again, could you explain to our audience what exactly it was? Because you looked over time, correct?
Well, that was looking at the depression. So sort of that other avenue of research I was mentioning, my previous existence, was depression and fatigue and sleep. And we know that these are all factors that relate to quality of life in any of us, really. But that was a study where we replicated findings from over a decade ago, looking at the role of sleep on fatigue. So fatigue is the most debilitating symptom individuals with MS report. And it's related to some of the biological and physical factors of the disease, as well as depression. And that's fairly known. But intuitively, what people didn't look at was the role of sleep disturbance. And sleep disturbance is very underappreciated in MS. And these data show that both 10 years ago and in the present, sleep disturbance is the number one contributing factor to fatigue in MS. So if we can address the sleep, we might actually improve fatigue. And related to that, sleep and depression are related. So if we can address some of the sleep, we might improve all these other symptoms that are related.
Before I go to Dr. Genova, let me just ask this to Helen and to Stephanie. Quality of life issues that we're talking about that are being studied at Kessler Foundation, could you describe your quality of life? Because it was almost 40 years ago, if you will, that you were diagnosed, right?
Yes.
What changed dramatically early on, and what has changed over time?
A lot has changed. When I was first diagnosed, we didn't have the tools or the knowledge that we have now. There was no medications. When I was first diagnosed, they used something called a hot bath test. They put me in a tub of hot water, and they did neural signs on me. That's how they diagnosed me. So things have changed tremendously over the years. When I was in nursing, and I had to leave nursing because I was signing my name backwards and I was getting numbers mixed up, I left, but I always tried to look forward to something else. I was always looking to research something productive. And I was always involved in something, so I didn't sit around and I didn't feel like I wanted to be, I wanted to be proactive and find out what was going on. So I was in the city, and my husband, we were dating at the time, and we got married, so we had children. Things materialized, and through all that, I had problems. But through research and looking and reading, we were always trying to make life better. And when we found Kessler, it made my life a lot easier because I learned so much about how I can make my own life better and be more productive and significant in life. And that makes me happy. If I'm productive and I'm doing something, that makes me happy.
Meg, let me just ask one more quick thing. You became a participant in research and studies because...
Because I wanted to be productive, I wanted to find out more about MS, and I wanted to help other people that were going through the same thing I did, because we didn't know back then a lot of different things, and we didn't speak out, and we didn't talk the way we're talking now. There was nobody to talk to.
But Meg, you also told me this. You said there are some others close to you who said, hey, because you've said to them, who you know who have MS, hey, why wouldn't you participate? Why don't you? And they say...
I'm afraid.
Of?
I'm afraid. I don't know enough to do it. I'm afraid to put myself in that position. I don't want to take a drug. I'm afraid to go talk to doctors. You know, they don't want to get involved. I mean, my own brother. I love my brother, but he's like, and he has MS, and he's in a wheelchair. I said, why wouldn't you get involved? Well, I wouldn't have the right answers. I said, it's not a right answer. It's being a participant and learning from us, and we're learning from them. It's a two-way street, and you're gonna gain from it. So why wouldn't you do it? So I think that researchers looking for participants like me and Stephanie to get involved. I mean, Stephanie's involved because she's in nursing. She's proactive doing what she's doing. I mean, that's fabulous, you know, going forward and making a difference.
Stephanie, why did you say yes? By the way, did you say yes or did you offer?
I think I offered. So when I was diagnosed, most of my disease activities in my spinal cord, which is actually a worse outcome, a poorer prognosis. And the first neurologist that I saw actually said to me, you know, you have a high chance of being very disabled and you should change your career path and your goals are not realistic. You have to reevaluate your life. And he clearly did not know me very well because I am much more stubborn than that. But you know, I was 25 at the time. I was doing this insane workout called CrossFit, and I was a musician, and I was a student. And, you know, I just kind of looked at him, and I said, you know, I'm 25, and chances are good that I'm going to live with MS for longer than I'm going to live without it. So it's up to me to set the tone, not you. And so I got a new neurologist, obviously. And, you know, I really started seeking out purposeful things to do, because that was not an acceptable scenario to me, and I was really desperate to find an alternative. So the first thing I actually did was I got involved in advocacy. So I'm very involved in government advocacy, and then research became a natural segue because I was advocating for increased research funding, and then I met some folks from Kessler, and I had some experience with them from my nursing days, and I said, you know, it's up to me. Right, I need an answer for me, but I also need an answer for my patients. And who better than to help get us there than somebody with MS who's also a clinician? So that's really my motivation, is to assign a purpose to what I've been dealt and to make the best of it.
Well said.
And you know, Stephanie, a lot of what you just said was exactly what happened to me. Doctor diagnosed me, said you're going to be a wheelchair in 2 years, told my husband not to marry me. I mean, talk about changing doctors.
This is not here, right?
By the way, you know, so you can't listen to, we have to be, like you said, be proactive and get out there and find out what we can do for ourselves.
Yeah, and it forces you to be flexible, too. Like, I have been excited about attending this event in person for months, but ultimately, you know, it's been a rough few months for me, and I had to stick around Virginia because I had to have my infusion today. And at first, yeah, it's discouraging because it's not what the plan that you had. But thankfully, I was like, hey, you know, I have this crazy idea. What if I just, like, videoed it and I could be a floating head in the room? It's the next best thing, right? So it's really taught me a very stubborn type A person to go with the flow a little bit more and to be a little bit more resilient. I think that's an important lesson for everyone, not just somebody living with MS.
Well said. Great. Very well said. Could I just do this? Let me ask you, Doctor. Your research, we were talking about this earlier, and by the way, when folks in public broadcasting and FIOS and other platforms see this, these interviews, they're going to be informed in a way they've never been informed before. But one of the things we talked about was the connection between MS and something in your research called, quote-unquote, emotional blindness.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? And I promise I'll come back to you, Lauren. Go ahead.
Sure. So historically, when you think about cognitive problems that people with MS feel, you think of memory issues, slowed processing speed, executive abilities. But this is something totally different, and it's very new. Basically, it's abilities that relate to how you interact with other people, how you perceive other people, and understanding the emotions of others. And what we're finding is that some people with MS experience significant difficulties understanding the emotions that other people feel. And this is brand new research. It's something that has only been looked at for the last couple of years.
For example?
So, for example, if you come home from work one day and you see your husband and he's feeling angry. But imagine if you couldn't understand that, if you thought that it was something else. You thought that he was tired. You thought that he was frustrated with something that he was doing. But he's actually angry. If you're missing that social cue, it may impact your ability to relate to him. And similarly with your friends, with your coworkers, to have an inability to understand their thoughts and feelings will really begin to impact interpersonal relationships.
So what is the research? You're telling me that there are specific things that you're doing to help, not just in terms of the research, but actually helping those who experience some of this quote-unquote emotional blindness.
Yes. So one study that we have here is we are using a 12-session program where people come in, they work on the computer, they look at facial expressions, and they begin to realize what parts of the face make up different emotional expressions. So they find out, what do angry eyes look like? What does a sad mouth look like? And they are better able to understand those emotions in other people.
You know what? Why don't we could we just show this video on, you want to help me set this up?
Sure.
On emotional blindness? Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. So we actually were interviewed by a team that works with Dr. Sanjay Gupta.
Is he a broadcaster?
Yes. And this was for the website Everyday Health, and it's on this exact topic, and Meg is a part of it too.
What if you couldn't tell whether your spouse was happy or sad? You didn't know when your kids were frightened or when your boss was angry. Make it pretty tough to navigate the world. Well, that is the reality for many people with MS. We are now learning that MS can damage the parts of the brain that allow us to recognize emotions in other people. What makes this even tougher is that many patients don't realize they're having a problem.
So on the screen, we have two different faces. So first, I'd like you to take a look at the face on the left. Can you tell me which emotion the man on the left is making?
Okay, well, his lips are pursed.
Margaret Balter is training to do something most of us do without thinking.
Think angry. That's good.
Angry.
Right.
Looking at a face and reading the emotion.
I'm going to say he's afraid of something. He's fearful. That's good.
MS researcher Dr. Helen Genova says most patients do not realize when they're losing this ability.
People with MS tend to know if they have memory problems. They tend to know if their thinking isn't as fast as it used to be, their processing speed. But this is not a problem that they're aware of. They may be aware that they're having interpersonal issues, such as more arguments with their spouse, for example, problems relating to people at work, but they don't know why.
Using an MRI machine, Dr. Genova watches the brains of patients like Margaret as they try to identify the six fundamental human emotions: happiness, sadness, fear, anger, surprise, disgust.
Those six emotions are universal. No matter the culture, no matter the person, they all understand what an angry face looks like, understands what a sad face looks like.
Patients are shown two faces in quick succession and must decide if both faces show the same emotion or different ones.
So if it's anger followed by sad, they would respond different. If it's anger followed by anger, they would respond the same.
Dr. Genova and her colleague, Jean Langenfelder, have developed a 12-week training program teaching patients to focus on particular parts of the face.
So, for example, in sad, the downturned lips. In anger, it would be a lot of tension between the eyebrows and a tight-lipped face.
So now what I'd like you to do, see if you can mimic a fearful face.
After training, patients do better. Their brains haven't been repaired, but they've learned a workaround.
Very good. So you got all the features of fear. You've got those raised eyebrows. Very good.
The problem is, since patients don't know there's anything wrong, doctors have to be the ones to bring it up. But this work is still relatively new, and doctors themselves are still learning about it.
I think the key is for first the doctors to be aware that this is a problem. I think if you walked into a neurologist's office tomorrow and said, are you aware of this, they would probably say no.
Dr. Genova hopes her work will raise the awareness so MS patients can get the help they need.
Once they understand the problem, there are a few things that they can do. Number one, I would say they shouldn't isolate themselves so that they are around other people constantly, because it's sort of like a use it or lose it type of a thing. The less you are with other people, the greater this problem could become.
With Everyday Health, I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Be well.
Wow. That is absolutely fascinating. What was that like, Mike, for you to see that?
It was eye-opening because two things happened for me. My husband would walk through the door at the end of the work day, and he'd come in, and to me, he always seemed like he was mad at something. And I came to realize that he was tired. He wasn't angry. He was tired. So I was misreading him. So that was one thing. And then if I'm out in a group and speaking with people, I see people look at me kind of funny. Maybe I'm not verbalizing correctly, or my words are getting jumbled up and they're looking at me. So it's taught me to be more aware.
Very helpful. By the way, Doctor, you wanted to say something. And I want to open it up for questions and comments right after this. Yes.
Not so direct. I think I just want to commend both Stephanie and Meg for their stories, because I think, imagine hearing that from your neurologist if you weren't the person that you were. So if you're already feeling scared and defeated, you already have poor coping skills, you're depressed, you don't feel like you have a sense of control, and you're being diagnosed with an unpredictable variable illness, it's hard to muster the energy and the proactiveness to say, no, I'm going to get on top of this. I'm actually going to change my life to this. And so that story exactly goes to my earlier point of who you are before your MS tends to drive how the outcomes might look.
So to that point, when Stephanie said, look, she was looking forward to coming to New Jersey to be with us tonight live, but because of what she was dealing with today, she couldn't do that, and she figured out a plan B. She's creative. She's proactive. She's got tremendous energy. She made us all feel terrible about her CrossFit training, and you know, that's another story. That's who she is. And
that's
so,
determining point. Yeah.
And that's a great asset. So for someone who doesn't have that attitude, that spirit, I hate to say, is their prognosis not as good, but their quality of life? Does the research show that it's just not as good?
Well, that's the big question a lot of people ask, right? Can you change this? This is sort of our traits. It's how we see the world. But that's also the principles of cognitive behavioral therapy and other psychotherapy, in which we identify how our inclination is by the virtue of who we are and our personality and our traits, and how we might take on something like MS, but teach a patient, how do you do it differently then? Because this is your inclination. You might get more depressed. You might feel more anxious. But we know this about you now. So how do we teach you to do it differently by acknowledging that this might not be your strength, per se?
John, you want to add something to this?
Well, you know, that kind of personality style, like Lauren was saying, you know, is very important, because there are people, for example, who have the opposite traits, who sort of give up and I have to go see the doctor for everything. For example, they're much less likely to adhere to their medication regimen. So there's these personality characteristics that can actually affect their health.
Wow.
And I think that's very, very important. And I think that's the kind of work that Lauren's been doing and discovering how resilience can really make you better.
Yeah. Questions, reaction? I'm curious. By the way, is there someone here who actually, I'm going to put it this the right way, who knows someone or is close to someone who has MS? Put your hand up. Who can say you've heard something tonight from one of our experts, our participants, that has actually surprised you about MS and MS research? Put your hand up if you're surprised by something you've heard. Put your hand up. What have you been surprised by, sir?
I don't know very much about MS, so it's really a very large learning curve for me right now. But I do know individuals with MS, and obviously this engagement is very enlightening.
Who else had their hand up? Because I saw several hands up of people who said, you're surprised by something you've heard. You're surprised by something you've heard. What is it? Could you just share with us? What have you been surprised by? Excuse my butt. I'm sorry.
I think it's the non-traditional approach to looking outside of maybe more of the clinical approach to how they're trying to bring things to resolution and looking sort of outside of maybe the expected and taking it down different avenues, which I think is a way that you're going to break boundaries in the future.
By the way, when you saw the research that Dr. Genova was involved in with some of her colleagues, that's showing the different faces and the reaction. What was that? You're making a face looking at that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, something that's completely unexpected. And, you know, it's taking sort of the smaller pieces of how people are affected and sort of dealing with them sort of head on, and I think in a very non-traditional manner.
With great impact. One other person who had their hand up. Yes. And now I got a bunch of hands I'm dealing with.
I have MS.
I'm sorry. Let me just come over here.
But I never knew about the feeling that somebody couldn't understand how somebody else was feeling. I didn't understand. I never knew that. I never knew that you wouldn't know if somebody was angry or sad or that kind of an emotion. And I've tried to help other people sometimes. I tried to help this one woman that had MS. My friend said, oh, Gretchen, you can help her. But I couldn't, and I had to let her go because she was just too much for me to be able to handle. She wouldn't leave her room. She was just so incredibly depressed, and it just wasn't working for me. And, you know, I told her about you all, that she'd go on over to Kessler and maybe they could help her. But I had to let her go for me because I had to go on with my life.
Gretchen, if I can ask you this. How aware have you been about, because I guess everyone who has MS experiences it somewhat differently, but how aware have you been about a lot of the things that were being talked about here before tonight?
I mean, well, I feel like I'm very, very lucky. I actually feel very lucky. When I was first diagnosed, I was older, but I was numb from the waist down and all that stuff and did the spinal tap, everything. But I get an MRI every year, twice a year, whatever. But, you know, I feel like my life is very, very full. I do have a spiritual life. I have a great family. I have amazing friends. I feel very, very blessed. And, of course, I try and help other people when they have MS. And so, you know, I'll get a phone call from somebody and they'll say, my secretary has MS. Can you talk to her? And I'll talk to her and do whatever I can to help. But, you know, there's only so much that I'm able to do because I'm not you. I don't have my master's, my doctorate, everything that you all have. I don't know any better than only what I feel. And, you know, the only thing I can do is to share what I've done and, you know, how it's helped me. I exercise every day. I try and eat right. I think these are important things that help me with my life. I'm surrounded by loving friends and family, and I think that helps a lot, too. And, you know, and a faith helps a lot for me. And so
thank you so much for sharing. Thank you.
Can I just jump in one
yes,
second
please.
Just to follow up on something you said?
Yes.
You said you can't do what we do, but we can't do what we do without you.
Yes. So what do you mean by that, Nancy?
Our research is all clinical research. We work with patients every single day. If we don't have the patients that are willing to come in and work with us, we can't make these discoveries. So you and Stephanie, Meg, other people with MS, and Meg was in my very first research study right out of grad school. Those people are so essential to what we do every single day. So I want to encourage you to try to get involved and to try to help us get these important findings out to the public and learn more and more. Just one more second.
We'll stay on that for a second before we go to the next point. Meg said something interesting earlier, and then you get to the next point, I promise. She said, when you're a participant in a study, sometimes you don't even know you are a participant. And we saw before, you obviously knew you were a participant. You said you're just part of it, and it doesn't change your life dramatically, and it was very rewarding. Do you think people are afraid because they don't know what they're going to experience?
I do. I believe that people are afraid to come in and get tested. And I've talked to a lot of different people. And again, people will call and say, well, I have MS. Can you talk to this friend? Or if you have MS and you want to talk, you call me, because you have to be ready to accept help. You have to be willing to come in and be a participant, because not only do you do the studies, but every once in a while they do group meetings and they share with us what they've learned. That betters our life. And if you're not there watching right there, you're missing out.
Absolutely.
It's not like it's,
And we're not doing voodoo. We're not doing voodoo. Where our primary goal is to keep everyone safe and to make the lives of people who have MS better. That's what we're trying to do. So we are not going to do anything that in any way, shape, or form will negatively impact any aspect of your life. So that's really important. But the other thing I wanted to mention was, in addition to the folks that have MS that come and participate in our research studies, we also need folks that don't have MS. We need healthy people. Because what we do is we compare the brain of someone who has MS to someone who doesn't have MS. And we need those healthy individuals to aid us in making all of these discoveries and developing these treatments.
Well said. We have a comment right here. Yes.
I just had a question regarding the facial recognition. I'm an older student in graduate school right now. We just did something on facial recognition. And one of the things I was wondering is, there's probably devices coming out, like the Google Glasses, how you can recognize faces. And I would think certain standard features of an angry face, a sad face, would, is probably a very useful tool that you're looking into. And I'm just not sure how at ease somebody would feel if they knew that, yes, I may face this weakness in the future, but if I'm just wearing this digital glasses that has an, algorithm that can recognize basic functions that would help you ease, I would think that would give comfort. But just not sure if things like that are...
I don't know. I have to admit, I don't know what Google Glasses are.
What are Google Glasses?
Well, you have glasses and they have a camera on them.
Okay.
And you can look at things. And I would think that if you had a camera that you could recognize and digitally read the certain parameters of someone's face, you could find basics that could send you a message.
Sure.
Angry, sad, and it would...
Sure.
If you're really suffering from something like that.
Well, I think what's kind of cool is we're training people to be able to identify those things more easily, to pay better attention to those things. So it's almost like without Google Glasses, you would have better ability to look for those clues that would tell you how a person was feeling, whereas before you may not have had them. So, yeah.
The technology is a great thing. And there may be ways to deal with problems such as this, but it's important to know, and this kind of research shows it, that the patient has to know they have the problem. Otherwise, the Google Glasses won't do anything.
Sure.
So the identification of the problem is critical, and right now this is so new that even the neurologists don't know about this, so that's really a critical part of it.
Well, now I got a ton of comments here. Yes.
You said what surprises you, and what I'm super encouraged by and surprised is the partnership between patient and medical people. It's kind of like medicine the way it should be, where the doctor is focused on the patient's quality of life because the patient is informing the doctor what the quality of life is. Do loop back to the doctor's improving that, and it's this kind of like do loop the way it should be. And I guess I'm kind of discouraged that a lot of medicine I see going on in our culture isn't like that. It's almost like the patient is the guinea pig, and the doctor is kind of like many of you have said, they just pronounce the diagnosis and off you go. You don't fit my, I'm not going to deal with you. And so I'm very encouraged by what y'all are doing with this emphasis on quality of life.
And the fact that the patient is so engaged.
And important and vital to the whole thing. I mean, you're part of what's going to lead to some quality of life for future MS patients. So I find that very encouraging.
Well, my quality of life through a study. Stephanie, did you want to talk?
No, Stephanie's engaged with her cat right now. Stephanie,
I'd love to interject, but
Stephanie, could you ask your cat to hold off so you can interject, and then I'll get Meg back in. Talk about that. because the comment that was made, I'm sorry, your first name again is?
Margo.
Margo said that she's so impressed that the patient is so important in the process. And you understand this from a variety of perspectives. Your reaction?
Yeah, so I think being a patient and a provider, that was one of my biggest lessons, is that both of you are experts. So now when I enter a room with a patient, they're an expert in what's going on with them and how the disease is affecting them, and I'm an expert in what medications and what therapies and what tests might be beneficial for that person, right? So we're really coming together as a team, and it's a very much a team approach. And we touched on patients who might maybe are less motivated, maybe don't have that resiliency that Meg and I do, and that's actually been one of the most rewarding parts of my career so far, because I have kind of a knack for taking patients that are less motivated and kind of putting them in charge of their own care, right? So for instance, I just saw somebody today who a year ago, I couldn't even get her to show up for an appointment with me. Until I called her at home and I said, look, you gotta come in, just give me a chance. Give me 1 hour of your time, I promise you won't regret it. She came in, she wasn't on medication, she was kind of in denial, right? She was one of those people where her kids came first, her husband came first, everyone came first, she was the last in line. And I finally gained her trust and I said, please just let me start you on a medication, so she did. And the only way I got through to her was to figure out what was important to her, because clearly herself and her MS was never going to be her priority, but I found out her priority was making it to her son's baseball game and being able to sit through the whole game without having to get in her car and run home so she could use the bathroom. So we used that as a benchmark for her success, and she let me start her on a disease-modifying therapy, start her on medication to control her bladder symptoms, and start her on medication to strengthen her legs so that she could walk from her car to the baseball field with all of her son's equipment. I mean, anybody with kids understands that scenario, right? So she came in to see me this week, and I've never seen her look so happy. And, you know, she's just said, thank you. I was so stubborn. I didn't want to own this. I did not want to take care of myself. But you made me be responsible for my care, and that was what changed my life. And thank you. And I said, I didn't do anything. You're the one that did this. So, you know, I think putting a lot of the responsibility on them and really letting them know that we're in this together, and this is really a long-term relationship, because I'm not just looking at you today, but I'm also trying to think ahead 20 years and what I want you to look like when I go get you out of the waiting room 20 years from now. And that's a goal that the two of us have in common. Mm.
Stephanie, is that your cat over there in the corner that we saw?
I don't think so. Maybe.
Well, who else could it be? Is there another cat in your house?
What's I've
been broadcasting for 25 years. I've never experienced anything like this. Yes, I have a comment right here. Yes, sir. You want to talk? The cat is not responding, so go ahead.
Comment and a question. First of all, everyone sitting up there, thank you for being here. What you do is, needless to say, amazing. And
absolutely.
Stephanie, we're sorry you couldn't be sitting here, but trust me, you're here.
Absolutely.
Okay. Even though tonight is not a fundraiser per se, obviously you need money to do what you do. So my question is, can you discuss some of the advancements with MS over the last year, 2 years, 5 years, where you've seen a major difference as to what money can help with?
Great question.
So let me just mention one example. So I've been here many years. Over at the hospital, about 15 years ago, they have a part of the hospital which is cognitive rehabilitation, which helps people with their cognitive problems. And we went there and said, how come you don't see MS patients in your cognitive part of the hospital here? He goes, well, why would we do that? They're a neurodegenerative disease. Why would we include them? Well, they learned about the research that we've been doing. We did a lot of studies showing that these patients with MS can get better, they can learn, they can have their memory problems alleviated. And you know what? Today, they have MS patients in their cognitive rehabilitation program. Came right from the research. And believe me, that research was not easy to get funded. You know, it was very difficult. It started with some small pilot funds. Then we have to be able to show an organization that we can have data that might look good to get a larger pool of funds. And so it takes a long period of time. But there was a reluctance to get the funding. It was difficult to get the funding. And the clinicians didn't see how we really could help patients with MS. Well, now we do. And it's all around the world. I can tell you that right now.
So, John, that's an excellent example of the research having a direct impact, because it isn't just researchers doing this research. It's saying, okay, now what do we do with it? How do we have impact on people's lives?
Right.
And being assertive with it, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Could you follow up on John's comments?
So we have one particular treatment protocol called the story memory technique.
What's it called again?
It's called the story memory technique. And I initiated that work along with John back in 1999 when I was a fellow. It started with a $40,000 grant from the National MS Society to do a study to examine the effectiveness of this treatment in 30 people who have multiple sclerosis. That study was successful. It was published. We then saw that there were ways to improve the treatment, so we improved it. We submitted for funding. End of story is it's been funded in different studies have been funded by the NIH, by the NIDLR, which is part of the Department of Education, by the Department of Defense, more money from the MS Society, from the New Jersey Commission on TBI Research. It's being used in multiple sclerosis, adults with multiple sclerosis. It's being used in adults with traumatic brain injury. It's now, we're adapting it now for a group administration because our clinicians are telling us that they can get it paid for by insurance companies better if it's a group-based program. So the DOD is funding us to do a study looking at it, particularly with a group administration. We're now moving it to pediatrics, so we're adapting it for children who have traumatic brain injury. So this one little $40,000 study that was an idea has grown into a multi-million dollar line of research. It's available in 24 countries. It's available in 4 languages. So it's really, we've really truly impacted the ability of clinicians to help patients improve their memory functioning. And Meg was actually in that initial study way back when. So it has a big impact.
Yeah, yes. Get more comments here. Yes, sir.
So I think two of the stories we've heard so far were stories where initial denial that I have it or try not to understand or recognize that you have MS, I would suspect that's a very common phenomenon. I could see something like that happening for myself in an active life. So, number one, how important is it that MS is identified early? And if it is important, are there things to do with the internet or other techniques to kind of reach out to the broader population to help identify people or help them identify and self-identify earlier?
Let me give you another example about identifying earlier and some of the important aspects. One of some of the research that we've done here has shown that individuals who have a very high intellectual lifestyle are actually more resistant to showing cognitive problems later in life. And so if you are 20 years old and you're diagnosed with MS, what happens a lot of times? You become depressed, you withdraw from society, you drop out of school, you don't get the intellectual stimulation that you need. But we know that if you are older and you've had a very high intellectual lifestyle, you may not show these cognitive problems. So to diagnose early and to say you need to stay engaged, be part of life, stay in school, be working, have a career, that'll actually help you in the expression of the disease. Not the disease itself, but its expression.
Follow up. Who wants to follow up on this? Doctor? Both of you.
I would say, too, that we're learning more and more what are the things that you can be incorporating into your life. So, for example, we're learning more and more about the effects, the positive effects of exercise. We have a study right now in aquatics, so exercising in water and its beneficial effects. And there were years when doctors would tell patients with MS, don't exercise. It's dangerous. It'll cause you to overheat. You'll get injured. You can't do it. And now we're learning that's actually the opposite of the truth, that there are exercise routines and programs that you can involve yourself in that have a huge impact on cognition, on mobility, on quality of life, wellness, a whole host of things.
And the research is telling us that.
Yes, absolutely.
Follow up.
So with regard to the denial, that goes back to, again, that sort of maladaptive coping. That's one of the biggest we have, as well.
What's it called again?
Denial.
Maladaptive
coping. and disengagement, behavioral and mental disengagement in dealing with the stressor in front of you. So we know this. And early on, it would be really helpful if practitioners brought in psychologists and health psychologists to kind of help address that right from the onset. And things such as staying employed is another great example. Many doctors say you might have to leave work. It's going to cause stress. Stress is going to make you have an exacerbation. So if you can't take 5 naps a day, then don't go to work. But we know that people who don't work end up becoming more depressed, more fatigued, have greater in healthy people, and are more likely to have cardiovascular risk problems within 6 months of being unemployed. So staying engaged and not maybe always listening to the neurologist in some ways, and doing what you think you should be doing for yourself. Mm-hmm. And the psychologist and health psychologist certainly are a large part of that and should be included in routine care.
I see a couple more hands. Yes.
I have several questions.
You got several questions? Okay, yes.
What can I say? First of all, how does your cognitive research overlap or cross over to Alzheimer's?
Great question.
Me? Okay. That is a great question. The pathological process that's ongoing in the brain, so the actual neurological problem, is very different in multiple sclerosis versus Alzheimer's disease. However, what is similar are the symptoms that people are experiencing. So once someone starts with a cognitive problem, what do you do? And that's really what we're addressing. So some of the work that we're doing now, such as the story memory technique, we're actually starting also in mild cognitive impairment, which is a very early stage, can be thought of as a very early stage of Alzheimer's disease. So if we're identifying these techniques to be helpful in MS, can we translate them to be helpful in an early Alzheimer's disease population? That's one of the questions that we're beginning to ask. So there are similarities that allow us to look at the treatments that we're developing and adapt them to be able to be most effective within that additional population.
You had a follow-up or a different question?
Yes. So instead of being more of a clinical research question, it's more of like a hard science question. So it was Meg, who said your brother also has MS. So I was wondering, one, do you find there's more genetics involved in families with MS? And two, my other part of the question is, have you found the causative agents in some MS patients to be bacteria or additional infections?
Sorry, where can we find your show? these questions are incredible. That's really a great question. Take it on.
You want me to?
Yes.
So there is there's definitely a hereditary component to MS. So
there definitely is?
There definitely is. So what we see in Meg's family is not uncommon. There is an increased risk of getting MS if you have an immediate relative that has MS. However, it is not a one-to-one relationship. So while you are at increased risk to get MS, there is a role of the environment, such as bacterial or viral agents. However, that's not clearly identified. So it's actually, the cause of MS is actually very complicated, and it's not definitively identified, but both of those factors play a role.
Okay. I want to follow up real quick on a question that was asked over here, having to do with, it's not so much, partly it's next steps, but the impact of the research again. If we could just say, if each one of you, because John, you've talked about it, if you could say what causes you to be most optimistic in spite of all the challenges that those who are dealing with MS face, and their family members. What causes you to be most optimistic about the research that Kessler Foundation is engaged in as it relates to the future of those who are dealing with MS? Take it on.
Sure. I think what's really great about the research we do here is that we look at things on a number of levels. So we have people come in and we test them so we get to see firsthand how they're improving after an intervention. But then we also use a technique like neuroimaging. And neuroimaging really allows us to see how the brain is changing after an intervention. And so it's really exciting to sit there and look at brains of people who participated in the techniques that Nancy has talked about tonight and to see how their brains have actually changed as a result of that treatment. So that makes me really optimistic about the future of the research.
Reason you're optimistic, Doctor?
I think it's Meg and Stephanie and Gretchen identifying these factors about people who basically are resilient and adequate in their coping, and they stay physically active, spiritually active, employed, all these things that basically ensure that they're still living their life to the fullest, and that we can help them do that and identify what are the key factors that determine for who and for when that happens.
Nancy.
There's nothing better than a patient coming back and saying, I finished your treatment and my life is so much better. You can't compare it to anything in the world. It's so motivating, and it really gives you hope.
I see a couple more questions here, but Stephanie, I see you shaking your head. You're optimistic in connection with the research because?
You know, the thing I appreciate about Kessler so much is that it's really important to be searching for what causes MS and how we can treat it better and ultimately how we can cure it. But I really appreciate the focus that Kessler has on improving the lives of people with MS right now. And I think that's what gives me hope, is that, yes, I'm looking forward to the future when we learn a lot more about this disease, but being in a room full of people who are so passionate about improving my quality of life, that's what keeps me going, honestly.
Meg, you got the final comment there, and I'll get a couple more questions here. Yes?
I recently participated last year in a study with Ritalin. I have extreme fatigue. Getting through the day was very hard for me. I wake up and look at that pillow and say, I can't wait to go back to bed. I'm just so tired. And I'd go through the day, and I'd make it through the day. But I went to a study, and it was Ritalin, and it was a double-blind study, so 1 month on, 1 month off, a washout. The end result is I'm on Ritalin daily, and I get up, and I am happy in the morning. I am happy to – I'm enjoying life better. I mean, it sounds – I mean, I just got to chill. It sounds strange, but, I mean, I'm happier because I'm enjoying life better. I have energy. I mean, to have that energy drained from your body to just – it's so hard to get through the day that I am really thankful.
Meg, you said that it changed your life.
It has changed my life. It really has. I'm focusing better. I'm at church and I see somebody's face and I remember their name. I mean, I can carry a conversation on and not lose the thread and feel like a dummy. You know, I'm an educated person, but I couldn't hold a conversation in a group of people. So this has helped me tremendously. I've been on it for a year now. And we adjusted the dosage with my neurologist, but if I hadn't participated in that study, I mean, it really has changed my life.
And it's in large part because you are part of that study.
Yes, and people that are afraid to take medications or afraid to do something, I mean, I benefited greatly from it, so.
Saul?
It's wonderful.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. This is extraordinary information. So the question earlier was, what was my takeaway? So it's almost disturbing to hear that doctors in the world don't realize the cognitive distinctions that you've uncovered. And my takeaway is that the people in this room and the more messages we can put out to others to be advocates and to make a contribution to your brother and to make a contribution to these people to participate and understand that there's not only, I guess, hope, but to be able to share the quality of life and the distinctions that you're experiencing is just, you know, it's like speechless. But I think my takeaway is to be an advocate for this work and send the message out to the people.
And I'm confident that that's all you speak for virtually everyone in this room. And I'm going to ask everyone right now to join me in saying with a hearty round of applause to our distinguished panel here, and to Stephanie in Virginia, say thank you very much. great. It was absolutely great. It was engaging. It was educational. It was inspiring. I assure you that, as I bring Roger up here, that for me, and I speak for all of my colleagues in public broadcasting who got into this, and I promise you it's too late, and I would never get on a soapbox right now. This is why a lot of us got into the arena of public broadcasting, to try to bring information to our audience that is important, that you may not find and are likely not to find in other arenas and other places. And it is because we've been exposed to this organization, this foundation, to researchers like this, forums like this, that we're going to be able to bring this discussion that we're taping tonight, these interviews, to a much larger audience. I'd like to say millions and millions and millions, but we're PBS. It's not that many millions. But an audience who needs to know it. And it's because of Kessler Foundation we're able to do that. So I want to say on behalf of my colleagues at PBS, thank you for allowing me to be a small part of this evening. And so on that note, I'm going to ask you to welcome Roger up here to give the final greetings. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it very much. Thank you. Steve, first, thank you for being such a great friend to the organization and sharing this with a larger audience than is here tonight, but also being a great communicator in terms of helping everyone to understand it and facilitate it tonight.
My honor.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. And my thanks to John and Nancy and Helen and Lauren as scientists in our organization that are so passionate about the work that they do every day and how they are translating their work right into patient care, whether it's at Kessler Institute, whether it's at the other select medical sites, or it's the world. And also to Stephanie. And Stephanie, I don't know if you can see me, but how are you? Thank you, Stephanie, so much. And Meg, thank you very much for what Steve had brought out, which is they're helping the next generation of MS patients. They're the ones that are assisting us in terms of understanding where we need to go in the future. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that there will be a future where MS will be cured. And I don't know when that will be, but I happen to believe that with all of the autoimmune diseases and the basic science that is taking place today, that when one of the autoimmune diseases like Crohn's or colitis or MS or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis is cured, that the learning curve will help us in the other autoimmune diseases. But until that time, we have to rely on the pharmaceutical industry with the major breakthroughs that they are coming up with in terms of drugs and remitting the disease and putting it into a state where individuals can continue their lifestyle. And we have to rely on individuals like John and Nancy and Helen and Lauren and other thought leaders here in science that are bringing the quality of life and addressing the quality of life issues that they have to live with every day. I remember when John started, I wasn't here, but John has told me this, that 29 years ago when he was working in the area of cognition and fatigue, that the medical community, Saul, as you said, they didn't recognize it. And yet today, through the evidence, the empirical evidence that has come about through the research that is being done here, it's known worldwide. Same with what Helen is talking about in terms of facial affect and emotional processing. She mentioned in the Sanjay Gupta video that most neurologists don't know about it. And it's our job to get our research into publication and present it nationally and internationally and move it into patient care so that others in the world can recognize the contributions that are being made in these areas. Now today, Helen just got word from the National MS Society that they're going to fund scanning in our neuroimaging center on the area of emotional processing, which she was just talking about, so that we can actually see the effects pre in terms of when an individual is before they start the intervention and go into the scanner and what the brain looks like, and after the intervention in terms of how the brain's plasticity, how the plasticity of the brain has actually changed. The same with Lauren. I mean, Lauren is talking about something that is near and dear to our heart because it's all about employment and how you keep people employed that have a disability. It's a huge expense in terms of going on Social Security disability insurance. And it's not a life where you're going to get rich being on SSDI and other forms of disability payment. The one area that you can help us, and this is not a fundraiser, is that you can help us with pilot funds. You know, your pilot funds, when you make a donation to our organization, we leverage those dollars. You heard them talk about how we take that pilot data and apply for NIH grants and Department of Defense grants and other major grants at the National MS Society that scale our research to large numbers that give the empirical evidence that's required to demonstrate to the rest of the world that the intervention that they're working on has meaning. The other important point is that when you make a donation to our organization, 100% of that dollar actually goes towards the selected area of research that you are interested in. And I say that because, you know, most nonprofits, they say that they operate, if they operate at 85 cents on the dollar or 90 cents on the dollar, they're a best practice. Well, we can say 100% because we're fortunate to have an endowment that covers our administration and our overhead so that when an individual gives us a dollar, we can put that dollar right to work. And it's not just that. It's the leveraging effect in terms of multiplying it by 15 to 20 times in terms of taking that dollar and using it to go after NIH and other types of grants. The other factor that I would mention to you that is so important about the foundation, and I would ask you to ask anybody that you give money to in research, is this question. When you're training the next generation of scientists, where do they go? Where they go in MS, the postdoc fellows and the visiting scientists from around the world, they come here. They come to train with these thought leaders and our other thought leaders in the field. Why? Because they want to learn how to write a grant. They want to learn how to win a grant. They want to learn how to conduct the research. They want to learn how to put the research into patient care because we're almost vertically integrated with Kessler Institute, where patients can come into our studies, and the great relationship that we have with the MS Society. So that's another important point. And we have trained over 30 individuals, postdoc fellows and visiting scientists in the field of MS, that if they don't join us full-time, they go on to make an impact in the field of MS somewhere in the country or around the world, back to their host country. So that's an important point for you to consider. The other point that I would mention to you is this, and that is you heard what Nancy talked about in the story memory technique developed here. It's now in 24 countries. It's being used in 22 rehab centers here in the United States, in 16 states. So when you think about the ability to think, learn, remember, and communicate, and you have MS, and you have lesions on the brain, and you start to have these functional issues of cognitive-related issues of memory, this is a technique that they developed and put into four different languages that is impact. That is impacting the lives of people that have MS. And that's my message tonight, ladies and gentlemen. It's all about impact. That's what it's all about in terms of research. If you are impacting the lives through the type of work that we do here every day, you're having a dramatic impact in terms of moving the needle forward, moving the industry forward, moving the help to patients with MS forward. I hope that you never have the need to be a recipient of the work that we do at Kessler Foundation. Whether it's an MS, or it's traumatic brain injury, or it's spinal cord injury, or it's stroke. But if you do, or if a family member does, you can be assured that right in your own backyard, right in West Orange, New Jersey, East Hanover, New Jersey, that you have some of the best scientists working in this area that are so passionate about the mission of this organization to help people with MS and all of the other diseases and injuries that we work on every day to try to improve the quality of life, which is what you heard about tonight. So I thank you for coming out tonight. We all thank you. We thank you for your interest. We have desserts outside, so I hope you'll stick around and talk to the scientists and the staff and learn a little bit more about our organization. Thank you very much for coming out.
For more information about rehabilitation research at Kessler Foundation, go to www.kesslerfoundation.org. That's www.kesslerfoundation.org.